الله أكبر الله أكبر.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the Islamic Center at New York University podcast, coming to you straight from the heart of New York City. We're building an amazing Muslim community here at ICNYU, where everyone is welcomed and respected no matter where you're from or where you're at. This is the place to be. So open your ears and your heart and come along with us on another life-changing journey. Bismillah.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah. Salatu wassalam ala Rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. So I thought today we would look at Surah Ma'un. It's the 107th chapter of the Quran. And last week, if you all remember, we were looking at just the idea of how to rebuild broken relationships. For those who were here last week, and what that means in terms of our impact with our relationship on Allah Azza wa Jalla. And so today, I thought we'd deepen in that conversation a little bit by looking at Surah Ma'un, which essentially can be divided into a couple of different frames. And amongst those frames is the idea of how we relate to people, as well as how we relate to Allah. I'm sure most of you are familiar with this chapter. It's one of the shorter chapters in the Quran, and likely have either heard it recited or might know it yourself and are familiar with its recitation. So what I thought we would do, similar to some of when we've looked at particular chapters of the Quran before, is go through it word by word, but try to understand in whatever sphere how it relates to us individually. And within that, we're going to talk to each other, hear from one another, similar to how our halakas usually go, and see where the conversation proceeds. So this chapter, Surah Ma'un, there's different opinions on whether or not it's considered to be a Meccan surah or a Medinese surah, right? And the distinction between a Meccan surah and a Medinese surah is not whether it was revealed in Mecca directly or revealed in Medina directly, but in relation to a milestone occurrence on the Islamic calendar, which is the Hijra, the migration from Mecca to Medina, where the Prophet ﷺ now establishes a community, a state, and the verses that are revealed pre-Hijra are known to be Meccan. The verses that are revealed after the Hijra are associated as being Medinese, and they have different contexts to them. They have different meanings to them. But it's important to understand because there's nothing without meaning in Allah's book. And so when we contextualize verses, they're also not meant to be just a historical understanding, but every verse bears impact to us. And of the benefits of knowing why something is Meccan or Medinese, it can give us an opportunity to be able to understand in real time what the audience is feeling or experiencing. Because they're not hearing it the way we're all seated together here, that somebody has pulled up a sheet and says, let's analyze this chapter, but it's coming to them as revelation is now being disseminated. And these are people who some of them have been Muslim for just moments of their lives. All of them are pretty much converts, right? One can make an argument that there were young people who converted at such a young age that they weren't anything other than Muslim. You know, so they say that Khadija radiallahu ta'ala anha was the first female to convert to Islam, right? Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu was from the first men. They say Ali radiallahu anhu wasn't even considered a convert because he was so young when he embraced Islam that he was already just on the fitrah. He wasn't ever in a state of being muqallif, meaning he was not one who was of an age of discernment, that at that time, he was just always Muslim. Does it make sense? But you want to be able to experience it for yourself by trying to understand what was the experience like for those as they heard it and as they took it. And again, it wasn't just in a space of You heard the verse and you kept it to yourself. But these were people who, as they heard it, they started talking to each other. We just got this from the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We just heard this new verse. As well as you had those who were adversarial to Islam that said, what is he teaching now? What is he preaching now? Did you hear what he said? And it's something that is important because as a text, it's also not a linear text, the Quran, right? If you've ever read another scripture before, they have a different sense of linearity to it. You know, here's the chapter that talks about this specific set of lineage. Here's this chapter that talks about this particular ritual. Here is a chapter that has a beginning, a middle, and an end to it. Other than the story of Yusuf alayhi salam that we see in the chapter named Yusuf, pretty much the rest of the Quran as a text has topics that are disseminated and dispersed throughout, right? So its linearity is something that necessitates getting used to it as a book on a whole. But in terms of what we are accustomed to pedagogically, it's very non-linear in that sense. It doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end chapter on this is the book of zakah, this is the book of salah, this is the book of tawheed. It's just all scattered throughout. Does that make sense? And so experiencing it necessitates recognizing some of this in a little bit of a different way. This chapter leads after Surah Quraysh, where we talked about that some weeks ago, right? And Allah says, فَلْيَعْبُدُوا رَبَّ هَذَا الْبَيْتِ أَلَّذِي يَتَعَمَهُمْ مِنْ جُوعٍ وَآمَنَهُمْ مِنْ خَوْفٍ, right? That then worship the Lord of this house, the one who essentially feeds you and he gives you safety and security from anything of fear. The Quraysh people, literally it's called Quraysh, the chapter of Quraysh. So they're being told in real time, like, wake up to the favors of your God, the one who's providing you with these things. And so Surah Ma'un now is following that, and it's in terms of order of the Quran. And as a Meccan surah, and we'll talk about where people think it's Medinese, right? If you look in the fourth verse, it says, فَوَيْلٌ لِلْمُصَلِينَ. So some people would say, well, they're talking about people of Salah, those who make salah, and the injunction for salah, and the mandate of salah, and the mandates of things, and the laws, and everything that's codified in that sense, you know, these tend to be associated with things that take place in Medina, not in Mecca. Because in Mecca, they're just trying to figure out how to survive, right? They're trying to figure out how to exist. They're being persecuted and boycotted. And then we'll talk about it when we get to that verse, but there's a lot that goes in the Quran that indicates that salah was something that people did, whether it was in that Meccan period, they had it as a term that applied to something. There's instances in the narrative of Ibrahim alayhi salam where, you know, they're told to essentially pray to make salah. And one would understand that to be at the Kaaba that they've constructed and built. So those would say, no, even in a Meccan context, people understood the concept of salah. But I just want you to think about that now. Like when we say it's Meccan and Medinese, it still has a purpose to it, right? We're not exhausting that list of purposes. But one of the things you want to get in your head is, what did it feel like to the Muslims at that time to hear this? What must have been going on through the head of those who had complexity to their identities, the affluent, the poor, those who are Quraysh, those who are non-Quraysh, those who are black, those who are slaves, those who are women, those who are people of all different backgrounds. It's happening in a real time. And as much as it then becomes applicable there, what does it mean to me here? These words that I say again and again and again. And so this first verse, it says, أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يُكَذِّبُ بِالدِّينِ. And so stylistically, the alif that's in the beginning here, can everybody see this? Should I make it bigger? The alif is creating now a question. And again, grammatically, you probably know this, but what's the point of a question in the Quran? Why do we have these questions? Why do you think God poses a question to you?
Is it rhetoric? Or?
It can be rhetoric. What else? To make you reflect. So I want you to think, if you've ever read this verse and you're hearing it for the 100th time, the 1,000th time, have you ever pulled out a notebook and written down this question and then contemplated upon it? Because that's part of what this is, right? It's indicating very directly. The Quran on a whole is a book that you want to do reflection upon, contemplate upon it. But in specific, the question is being given to you, right? It's being directed to the Prophet alayhi salam, أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يُكَذِّبُ بِالدِّينِ. But to you as the reader also, do you see the person who they are in denial of the deen? It's not meant to create judgmentalness. It's not meant to create an opportunity to elevate oneself by denigrating other. But the Prophet sallallahu ta'ala alayhi wasallam, who is an individual that was sent to be a mercy to the world, has the best of character, is a person who treats everybody with the dignity and respect even more so than they deserve, right? The Quran says that don't say uff to your parents. Anas ibn Malik, who's the khadim of the Prophet, a young boy, says, Muhammad never said uff to me. Right? Taking it to a different level and degree. So it's not a point of reflection that's meant to now stoke the ego, but a point of reflection that is meant to build purpose. As an instrument, it's teaching you to take in a beneficial way. So the first thing I like for you to do is just talk to each other. If you don't know the names of people that you're seated with, what is the benefit of reflecting on this in this way? What are some of the things that we can take in our own individual contemplation? Last week, when we were talking about healing broken relationships, we talked about the importance of solitude, self-care, having a place of stillness and reflection, right? So when you go to reflect, there's a point to it. The point to this is not to make yourself believe that you're better than someone else in a way that feeds into arrogance, but there is a benefit to it, and there can be multiple benefits. So I want you to turn to the person sitting next to you, right? And just kind of discuss, what can we gain through reflecting in this way? Both with the specificity of the question, but also as a process, what is it teaching us about the process of reflection? Right? What is it giving us an insight to in terms of setting up the ability to process? Does it make sense? So let's talk about that for a few minutes, and then we'll come back and kind of hear from somebody or from everybody. You don't have to speak Arabic. No, just read the translations.
No, I was going to say, I didn't know that Dean, so I always thought like it meant like faith or something else.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Don't mind the translations. There's a couple of definitions for deen that we'll look at, but just think about the reflecting part to it right now, right? And then we'll come back and discuss. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah,
work forward to the campaign itself to give you a reason to issue certain things. And everything, and like, you know, that. So that was the same level, like, yeah. Same level to do that. And then you do things of the kind of pushing through and just like the payoff function. Mm-hmm. It wasn't smart, but it shouldn't be able to do it. It's something like if you're going to get one, you're going to get one. And it's a little bit happier. Yeah. So then I think that my life is kind of like that.
Kind of a, I feel like that's one of the best things about meditation. It's like picking up like everywhere, like all the, you know, meditation. It's like people are starting to realize how what it is, they're kind of feeling what it is, what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's
one
of
okay. So maybe starting with the nature of reflection, what is this giving to us as kind of a guideline in our own processes of reflection and contemplation? What are some of the things that we can get from Allah as a beneficial tool when you're reflecting? What do you pull from this kind of prompt of reflection? What do we talk about?
Look inwards, like look at this question, like apply to yourself and see.
You apply it to yourself, but how are you applying things to yourself? What is it telling you to look at?
Your level of iman.
What else? What do you think? Is it telling you to look at you? Is that what this is saying? The Prophet is being told this, right? Is he being told, look at yourself? What's he being told?
Have you seen it?
To look at something else, right? Does that make sense? Why? How does it relate to like kind of the guidelines or the natures of reflection? When you're in this space now, like what is it giving as like one of the steps of reflection that you can engage in? There is a benefit to reflecting on yourself. And it's not an either or, it's a both and. But here he's being told, like, look at those around you, right? Look at the people that exist around you. Why? Why is that an important way to reflect?
We were talking about it being like easier for you to reflect on yourself through stories about somebody else, which is probably not what you're getting. I think
it could be, yeah.
But yeah, just the idea that like when okay, you define in the negative people who can feel like they're doing something bad with regard to the deen, even if you maybe in general wouldn't think of that as yourself. Maybe the way that they define you can be able to deem after that tells you something about yourself that maybe you don't want to be considered part of that group. Or, yeah, you don't want to follow that example. You wouldn't call yourself that. But once it's been defined, you think maybe that is me. But you don't feel the same sense of like attack. Like, as if the example were directed just at you, like you feel like you're being shamed or something like that.
Great. Other thoughts? What else? So much of how we learn can very much so be very indirect and with an absence of consciousness and presence. Right? Like my kids are now 7. My son just turned 7, mashallah. My daughter is going to turn 10 in December. And one of the things that my children are really good at is taking a long time to eat their food. And if you have little people, young people in your life, and you've ever seen them, right? Like from the time my kids have started to eat by themselves, they eat super slow. It takes them sometimes 45 minutes to eat a bowl of Cheerios. Not 3 bowls or 5 bowls, but sometimes 1 bowl. And I'm not exaggerating. You can ask my wife, you can even ask my daughter and my son. It's a conversation that we have quite often. And early on, I would say to them, you just got to focus. And they just look at me and nod their heads and say, yes, Baba, yes. And then after doing that for many weeks, I realized that I'm the one that has no idea what he's doing. Because how would my son, who is at that point probably 4, and his sister was then 6, or a little younger, a little older, know how to focus when no one has ever explained to them, this is how you do it. And in the absence of being taught or trained a structured mode of this is how to focus or to learn focus or to be increased in focus, we then organically and unconsciously spend the crux of our existence living in the absence of focus. We're still learning how to be unfocused, and that becomes one of the defaults. Until somebody can deliberately set us down and say, this is how you build this in. Built into this verse right from the onset is one of the methods and modes in which you can start to apply reflection. Because there's so much that goes into kind of common jargon around the importance of mindfulness and consciousness, but the how-tos are not given. Our spiritual tradition is not devoid of this. And there's not many verses in the Quran that only mean just one thing. So you don't want to take reductive approaches to your relationship with the Quran. So one of the things the Prophet ﷺ is being taught in this mode of reflection, and in turn by us, is that just learn from the people around you. Like, look to the examples that surround you. And you can attach it to the latter part of this verse, but you can also just take it from the first few verses, the first few words, and say to yourself, like, am I taking it in and reflecting through what it is that's happening around me day to day? Do I really see, not in the most literal sense of it, but with basira, vision of the heart, the examples, the character, the demeanor, the persona of the people around me? And am I taking an opportunity in my own muhasabah, my own inventorying, to try to draw meaning from it, right? To take from it. Do you know what I'm saying? And so one of the ways you can do this is by just reflecting on what does it mean for us to understand how to be by looking at the people, looking at the world around us, right? Do you ever go to your office and you see the guy who's just not happy, but has spent so much time chasing after dollars? You don't have to belittle or denigrate that person. Do you ever see the couple whose relationship is not working out because one is stuck in an office place all the time? One is not appreciating the other. Do you ever see those who find contentment and balance in their life and get to a place where it's not rooted in bitterness or envy or jealousy or self-deprecation, saying that they're like this, meaning I'm not that, so I can't find contentment, versus like opening your eyes and to say that that person looks like they have such fulfillment, not in a superficial way, that creates now in a consumer-driven society a sense of dissatisfaction in order for us to continue to purchase what the society is telling us is integral for our happiness. But in your own inward state, being in a presence of somebody, being like, why is that person always so positive? Not like annoyingly positive, but like in a nice way positive. How do they get to that place? What does it mean to really be successful? And is the definition of success that is societally normative the success definition that I want to follow? And I start to really think and sit and answer subsequent questions by first being able to understand and truly reflect on what these things are. Why do we have stories of prophets? Why do we have stories of companions? Why do we have so many stories that are given to us? It's not so we can just regurgitate and parrot them, but you take from people and you reflect and you contemplate, and then you do bring it back to yourself. You do have inward reflection that says, how does this apply back to me? So one of the constant modes of reflection you want to sit and you want to engage in, which is not judgment. It's not you looking down at somebody. It's just to open your eyes and to take from What does it mean to be a good father? What does it mean to be a good spouse, a good child? What does a terrible child look like? How do you start to reflect on things by taking from examples around? Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? And it's a part of reflection. It's not the only thing that goes into reflection, but it's a part of reflection. It's very necessary. Because the other part to this is then just kind of mindless movement forward. You know? When Surah Lahab comes down, Abu Lahab is one of the people who, when the Prophet ﷺ has people's attention and is giving them an opportunity to have insight, he says to him, "Taban laka ali hadha jamatana, that may you be perished. This is why you gathered us together." And he's of the elite. He's of the nobility. He walks away annoyed that he's been taken from his business and his trade and making money. And as he moves, everybody whose attention was absorbed now just simply follows him. Not for any other reason other than he's doing it, we're going to follow in accord. The state of the believer is unique because you don't just do it because someone else is doing it. You're in a state of wakefulness. And you start to reflect on the world around you, the people around you, the things around you, society around you. And as part of your reflection, you start to build in an idea of, what am I learning from the examples, the people around me? What am I really taking from them? Positive and negative. What is it doing to shape me as a person and where I want to be? Not in a worldly sense of success, but in an otherworldly sense of success. And when I stand in front of Allah, who do I want to be when I stand in front of Him? And so that reflective part becomes important. Pay attention. Learn from those that are around you. And what's really key here also is that you can pretty much take from most people. You don't want to identify people by their job titles. You don't want to identify people by their level of wealth and affluence. You don't want to identify people in ways that are just simplistic and superficial, but you want to really see them as whole people and take from them. There's some of you who are sitting in this room who have amazing conversations with Officer Black, who's our security guard downstairs. You know him, you know his family stories, he knows your names. And there's some of us who would never think to learn the name of the security guard. Do you get what I mean? You want to be in the former, not in the latter. And you want to see that there's a benefit in it for you more than anything, that it creates now an inroad to information that at the very least will allow for you to reflect and still have growth for yourself. So here in specific now, it's giving us a very particular thing to reflect upon. أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يُكَذِّبُ بِالدِّينِ. The utilization of the word الَّذِي is giving now an opportunity for two understandings grammatically. One, it's being understood in a very specific way, that this is speaking about those individuals like Abu Lahab, like Abu Jahl, other individuals from the Meccan society who had authority. They were in control, defining and dictating policies, societal norms. And it also, this al-ladhi has the meaning of something that's more generic. So it's not just specified to them, but in a more generic sense, it's giving an indication. Now think about this in both frames. It's not giving a broader sense of many people, but it's coming back to the individual one. So anybody in real time who's hearing this verse, Abu Lahab is hearing the verse, Abu Jahl is hearing the verse, the early Muslims are hearing the verse, those who are kind of on the fence are hearing the verse. All of them are in this place, and it has the opportunity for them to think in two directions. That what does this say about our leadership? If we take the specific understanding, or what is it saying and is about to tell me about myself? As much as now I can see, I'm also the one that's being seen. Does it make sense? Yukadzibu is distinct because this is rooted in the root letters kadaba, right? Which denotes lying. It denotes kind of a mendacious nature about somebody, right? It's different from the word kufr. It doesn't have a derivation rooted in kufr. And so the explanation of this can be about one who knows inwardly what's right, but is still pushing it away. They understand in an inward sense that this is what I should be doing. And the verses that come after, they're going to give indication of this more. I should be taking care of the orphan. I should be giving food to those who are in need. I should be one who is conscious and mindful of my prayer. I should be one who is not haughty or proud in the performance of my actions. And so many would say that this verse and verses subsequently, they talk about the munafiqeen, those who outwardly express Islam, but inwardly they're not kind of aligned with it. It also is giving insight to individuals who it allies itself with this last word, deen, that has a few different meanings to it, right? So what were you saying was one of the definitions of deen?
I mean, I was kind of interpreting it as faith.
Yeah, right? Faith is iman. So it's not to make it semantical, right? But we become subservient to language. And at the juncture that we're in, we're exactly where we're supposed to be. So you don't want to think this is what I should know or I'm supposed to know. But language is very, very important, right? So if we mean faith, you want to think about what the words mean to me individually, but what does it mean to a collective, right? So by faith, we don't mean iman, but by faith, we mean like a faith, correct? Like a deen, a religion. So it's talking about Islam. Do you see the one interpretation says that they are yukadzibu bid-deen? They are in that state of rejecting Islam and everything that goes along with it. Rejecting Allah, rejecting Allah's messenger, rejecting everything that comes with it. What this deen also means is in relation to the idea of owing somebody something, right? That's why the Day of Judgment is called Yom Ad-Din, because it's a day of accounting. It's a day where everything is made straight. This is what we talked about last week. If you don't deal with your relationships in this world, before there is eternal existence, everything is balanced out. So you got to either figure out the mess that's here today, barring abusive situations. You got problems with people. You don't figure it out here, it's going to get figured out over there. Right? May Allah grant us all ease on that day. So Yom Ad-Din is giving us an understanding that there's rooted in this word, deen, is the idea of owing. It's the idea that there's still recompense. This is the hardest theology for people in Mecca to accept. A lot of people, it's not hard for them to understand that there's one God, Tawheed, monotheism. My kids, who are little, again, right? And some of the best modes of engaging in spiritual increase is to just talk to little children, because they're just beautiful, innocent people, right? And may Allah allow for us to heal from any pains that we've had as children and to nurture the young people in our lives. My kids, not because they're special, they're beautiful, but not because they're unique. Most children can innately understand the existence of a God. Most people also, if you really talk to them, they can accept the idea that there's a God. They can accept the idea that there's a messenger. You can accept other things. What's really hard for people to accept is the idea that there's a day of judgment, that there is an afterlife, that there is accountability. The Meccans that were hearing this, they don't want to hear that how they treat people is an important thing. They don't like to hear the fact that one day they're going to be taken into account for everything that they did, everything they could have done but chose not to do. And that's both in the capacity of what's good and what's not good. رَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يُكَذِّبُ بِالدِّينِ. Do you see those who they live as if there's nothing more than this world? Do you see what people are like who they don't actually believe that there is a life after this one? You can be a person who believes in God, who believes in Islam, and you don't live your life as if there is a next world. They're all separate theological points, right? Can you believe that Allah exists and still be indifferent to the idea of an afterlife? Yeah, you can. Can you believe that Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was the last messenger sent to mankind? And you can still live an existence that is in denial of the fact that there's a day of judgment. There is a day where everybody is going to be resurrected. Right? And that's a really important thing to think about. Because in this day and age, societally, we don't deal so well with mortality. It's a world that teaches you in this part of the world to throw your old people into a place that's hidden away. You don't want to see people getting old. The billboards don't have wrinkly faces on them. They have people who live from a societal standpoint of beauty outwardly that always just perpetually look beautiful in that sense. Until recently, where they've made a way to monetize off of other forms of discerning what beauty is, you still have the fundamental notion that people aren't comfortable with death. They don't really behave as if there's something else that's in store for them. How is it possible that there's people in the world that have the amount of money that they have? You cannot have that many billions of dollars unless some point of your revenue generation is rooted in exploitation of people. It's not possible. The glorification of war, military industrial complex, prison industrial complex, the way healthcare functions. How do people demonstrate that there's anything bigger than this world? Through their decisions, their choices, their actions. When you start to look at them, and then you reflect back to yourself, how does my life that I live demonstrate that I believe that there is something that's coming after this world? And it's a critical theology in the Meccan period. These guys are burning their daughters alive. They're mistreating people who are different racial backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds. There's individuals who come into the Meccan society doing trade, and they're not paid for their business. And the elite, those who many say this verse is specifically talking about, if the entity is understood with specificity, they start to play games with this merchant. They're not getting paid. The person is told, you know who can help you in this instance? Go to Muhammad ibn Abdullah. Because they know in that early period, these are people who have been dropping the intestines of sacrificed animals on the Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They have been boycotting, beating, abusing, even killing his earliest followers. So when the merchant comes and he says that those people told me that you could help me, the Prophet says, is that what they told you? And he says, yes. He goes and he knocks on the door of Abu Jahl. And he says, give this man what is owed to him. And he says, right now, O Muhammad, he says, right now. And he gives it to him. And the elite of Mecca, they go to Abu Jahl and they say, what? Why did you do that? We were creating an opportunity for you to ridicule and mock Muhammad again. And he says to his friends, if you saw what I saw in the face of Muhammad, you would have done the same thing. They didn't care. They're willing to play games with people, to mistreat them, to say, I'm just going to do whatever I feel like. My feeling is going to determine my choices, my actions, what is subjective to me, what is relative to me. I'm going to get mine, whether it means others don't get anything at all or not. They don't believe. Their actions don't demonstrate it. And it's an important theology. And so you want to think for yourself. So if you could turn now in pairs, there's a couple more people here. You want to talk in pairs so everybody gets a chance to talk. You want to hear your thoughts, right? أَرَأَيْتَ الَّذِي يُكَذِّبُ بِالدِّينِ. What makes it hard sometimes for us to remember that there's a world beyond this world? And what are some of the things that we can do to help us remember? To remember that every step we take in this world bears impact on how we relate to the next world. Decisions, choices, actions, they're not meant to create a sense of paranoia or anxiety, but a sense of empowerment, right? The notion that there is a world, eternal bliss, is meant to be liberating and empowering. So what I'd like for you to talk about briefly is, how did you learn about this concept to begin with? Go back into your own experiences with the idea of an afterlife, a day of judgment. What does that mean? What are some of the things that make it hard to remember something? Right? Because it's a remembrance question. It's a reflection question. You know? That's what dhikr is. Dhikr is not learning something, but dhikr is when your mind is in a place and it suddenly becomes empty of something that you want to have present, you're able to bring it back and remember it. You're able to push it to the forefront and not have it get stuck someplace else. So what are some of the things that make it hard to remember that there's something bigger that we have in store for all of us? And what are some of the ways that we can facilitate that to help us remember it? Because you don't want to be the evidence of this verse, right? You don't want to be from amongst those who they deny the idea that there is something that comes after this. You get what I mean? So we want to be able to understand it as best as you can. And some of the things that are important, not the space to say who's right and wrong. Somebody says something, just listen. That's how we learn and we grow, right? We're at a pace now where we know we can just spit out articles of faith. You want to think deeply now. What does it mean to me? How do I build a relationship with it? So these three things. When did you start hearing about this? And it's okay if you've never heard about it before. That's fine. Two, what do you think gets in the way of being able to remember it, to have decisions informed by it? And three, what are things that can help us to facilitate a better relationship to it? Things that can help us keep it in mind in a way that makes us courageous, not in a way that has us walking on eggshells, right? That's not the idea, to be in a state of trepidation, but it's to live to your fullest ability through your belief. Your belief is meant to give you courage. It's not meant to have you kind of waver. Does it make sense? So find somebody, introduce yourselves. If it's not possible to do two, which should be possible, do three at most, right? Which means not everybody talking to each other, but get comfortable talking about your religion, right? Get comfortable talking about some of these ideas and hearing what other people have to think. And then a few minutes, we'll come back and discuss. Okay, great. So how did you even begin to relate to this? Like, what were some of your first memories? Who taught you about the afterlife, the Day of Judgment, its importance? Any thoughts? Maybe we can start there. Nobody?
Grandparents?
Your grandparents?
Yeah.
Your grandparents?
Yeah.
What did they tell you?
It's a very vague memory, but early on, I used to see them pray, and he used to teach me how to pray, and I would have questions, and he would tell me about. I remember there was a time I was eating papaya, and I laughed, and I said, I hate it. And he said, it's the fruit of Jannah. And I said, yep, then I don't want to go to Jannah. And he got really upset. He said, you can't say things like this, and Jannah is going to be amazing. Like, those are some of the early memories.
I agree. Where are you going to say?
Same example, but from my at least from my parents, was, you know, if you're eating food, you don't finish it, you're gonna, you know, if you don't finish it, you're gonna go to hell. Like 11, telling me that was like, it was more so as like a fear mechanism.
Sure.
But eventually, like, then I went to Sunday school, and then I learned more that it's not, yes, it's not fear, you know, it's more motivation.
Like, you see how intrinsically now we attach memory that is rooted in this very kind of challenging framework of religion, that if and when we were taught, like not the direct content, but most of the time the afterlife was brought up, was in relation to something you weren't doing right. You made a mistake. This is wrong. And you're going to get punished. You see? And it creates core belief, which is different from abstract theological belief, the belief in God and angels and books. Your core belief, cognitively, everyone has core beliefs within them, right? I'm worthy of love. I'm not worthy of love. I'm, you know, worthy of success. I'm not worthy of success. Moments like this, they can shape for us an understanding that I'm just not worthy for this place. Or why would I want to go to this place the way you're defining it to me? You can't have this verse in isolation. You got to read like other verses. Read the verses that talk about what Jannah is like and try to think about what that means. Build a relationship to it for what it is, not what people created. Do you get what I'm saying? But if the same way somebody told you from when you were a little kid, you're stupid, you're stupid, you're stupid. You do everything wrong, you do everything wrong, you do everything wrong. And then there's an absence of what you do right. There's a deep wisdom in the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam telling the children in his life that he loves them. And how then they're going to understand his teachings that speak about the realities of an afterlife. You get what I mean? You got to reflect. All of it goes back to reflection. You have a life that is all connected to each other. Just like all of you is connected to the rest of you, you can't suddenly just erase a day that you have lived previous to your current day of existence. And so things shape for you consciously or unconsciously. We want to consciously shape a relationship with our theologies, with our convictions. Because you can't believe it just because somebody else believes it. Your belief is inside of you. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? What else? What else? When did you experience, what are your relationships to this concept of an afterlife? Maybe somebody on this side.
I was just sharing with them how I do grow up in the U.S. unfortunately. And when Dad, I'll forever be very sober and over him. But he's home in Germany, and the majority of the country took him to like leave the faith and come back to it. So he really had teaching the basic, and this is what I'm teaching you about. And so I didn't really get a sense, like, I don't have an early memory of discussions around the judgment, what now, why it's not about, you know, why he doesn't do that, and why he has to school. And those are very much like the finality of being able to like, oh, it's almost like this guy that now and all of that inside to like why you're here and it's really coming to be experiencing that kind of gave me a bit of understanding of just how it's it was so deep and important how to deal with the reality and making it work in my job.
But it's the most important part of the afterlife, what you're saying, right? That fundamentally, both heaven and hell are still just creations of the creator. And if you don't put all of these things together, it won't make sense, right? You know, Rabi al-Basri, she says very famously, I will not serve Allah like a laborer in expectation of my wages. You know, and you have individuals who are luminaries of our traditions, that they're not in service. They don't live in existence because they are in pursuit of Jannah or they are living to avoid Jahannam, but they're living to just build the relationship with the creator of Jannah and Jahannam. Do you know what I mean? In his infinite wisdom, he gives us insight that there's something that's coming. That accountability factor is very, very critical. It's what one of the hallmark aspects of this religion that make it distinct from other religious traditions. It's really important, accountability. When you turn off like your heart as an organ of cognition, and you're in a place now where everything that comes from it, reflection, contemplation, intellectual capacity, you're just on default settings. Eating, drinking, physical intimacy. My job is just about getting a degree or getting wealth that then makes me like worthy of a marriage partner. That's not what your life is fully about. It's just fundamentally not. Everything is rooted in elements of worldly success. So you had a prophet who literally slept on a straw mat that left marks on his back. And when his companions saw it, would bring tears to their eyes. They understood the proportionality of this world to the next. It doesn't mean that wealth in and of itself is a problem, but the questions around wealth are going to be asked. How did you attain it? And what did you spend it on? All rooted in a sense of accountability. There's mindfulness, there's presence to it. Do you get what I mean? What are some of the benefits to having this as a belief? Like, if you can embrace accountability, what's the benefit of that? Why is that a necessary conviction that you can gain from? Yeah.
I think it falls into this, like, paradigm of justice. Like, if you're living in a world where there's a lot of injustice and you don't believe that these people are going to be held accountable one day, or on the other side or on the reverse, if there's a lot of good people in the world and then you don't believe that they'll ever get rewarded one day, then it just feels like there's something asymmetric there. Like these people will never get what they deserve in the end.
Yeah, I sometimes need the notion of accountability to be able to understand God has my back. Even when the world forgets the mistreatment, the abuse, right? We talked about this last week, broken relationships. When it seems like nobody understands it, Allah is saying everything's going to be made sense of on that day. Everything is going to be made balanced. Everything is going to be put right. And not just in the prism of inequity and injustice, but also in terms of sacrifice, living a life of beauty, service. There will be people who are rewarded. What else? What are some of the other benefits of being able to really embrace this idea of accountability? Yeah. That was off.
So it can give you a sense of balance, because often when you walk out of this place, the world isn't as like black and white as you make it out to be. You can still use some sort of stumps. That's really important.
How does it do that?
By for me, it's about your moral compass, kind of sets it straight, as opposed to like you mentioned worldly pleasures and also like chasing everything off or just proving your balance that you're successful.
Yeah, I need accountability. I need to be able to have a prism that says there's responsibility that I have towards others, right? In Allah katab al ihsan ala kulli shay, that Allah has prescribed ihsan on everything. There's rights, there's responsibilities. My body has a right over me. My heart has a right. My soul, my ruh, it has a right. My neighbors have rights. My children have rights. The people who work for me, the ones that I work for, my community has rights. Everything is fundamentally in this space. It's usually not those who are in the lower elements of a power dynamic that are in a place where they deny accountability. They're the ones that are denied mostly. It's those that have some semblance of power in their favor. The power balance goes towards them that creates an ease to reject responsibility, to deny accountability, to feel as if they're untouchable. That's crazy. You don't want to have that mindset. And the verses that come after, they're going to give us illustrations. What are some of the things, just before we move on, and we'll go through the rest really quickly. We're going to stop right before Maghrib time, inshallah. What are some of the things that make it hard to be able to build a relationship with us? Or some of the things that make it easy? Like, what are, maybe we'll start with the things that get in the way. What gets in the way? What gets in the way to have this as a foundational conviction or a belief, a theology that I can embrace? What did you discuss? Did you discuss it? Why do I forget it so easily? Yeah. You don't have to say salam every time. It's nice to go, right? But you don't have to.
If you have an unhealthy lifestyle, so if you, like, if you have a, if you're surrounded with people who aren't like, on the right path, or your environment is a big, like, a big portion.
Yeah, and think about these things now with kind of a prism of its opposite also. So if my day is surrounded with individuals who don't share a common belief system, it doesn't mean that they're terrible human beings, right? But there's a difference that's there, and you have to be able to recognize it. So if I live in a society that is very much so materialistic, it's secularized, not secular that it's godless, no one talks about God, but fundamentally, it concludes that this is it. This is all that exists, is just here. So everything's just going to be about how much I made, what did I do, how much I, you know, was kind of, you get what I mean, right? It now becomes a responsibility individually that you bring yourself to places that help to inform parts of your growth spiritually, and you make time for this part of yourself. So being in certain environments dilutes it. What are the environments that I can be present in that uplifts it, that gives it clarity, that doesn't make it an either or? I got to go to work. I got to go do these things. But embedded within it is a need for me to be able to still have clarity that I determine how I can relate to the acquisition of it. So I find some good friends to be around, right? That's why I have you talk to each other. One, so that you can get comfortable talking about your religion. Not in a way that's reactive, but you start to think about what you think about. And two, they're all nice people. You can talk to each other here, you can talk to each other out there. You build relationships with one another. You get to know who you're praying with. That's how community formulates itself. It's not hard, man, to get thousands of people in the room. It's not. It's really hard, though, sometimes for people to fully pay attention to the people around them. And to not be able to, like, look at somebody, right? How can you tell somebody cried if you never look at them in the face? So why would you not want to provide a shoulder to someone to shed a tear on? that's gone through just difficulty. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? What else? What are some of the things that get in the way? People we're around, company we keep, anything else?
Sometimes, things are going really well in life. You kind of tend to forget, like you get too busy with focusing and feeling like everything is going great, and you tend to forget Allah and Akbar and other things.
Okay, great. What were you going to say?
Just like sometimes we're attuned to like go for instant gratification, over delayed gratification. There's that experiment with like children where you give them one marshmallow now or like two marshmallows 2 hours later, they'll always pick like one now. So with things like this, like that seem far away, but you never know what's going to happen. You choose to go for like things that give you both instant gratification.
Yeah. Other thoughts? What else? Did you have your hand raised? Anybody else? What gets in the way? Yeah.
If you're coming from like, it's not just environment, but if you experience traumatic experiences, you push it like you're just the self-defense.
But it's different, right? Because this is talking about people who are actively rejecting. If somebody's now in a place where they are a survivor of trauma, if they're in a place now where wrong has been done to them, that's different from the person who consciously has blessing in their life and chooses to just stop remembering God. Right? Do you see the distinction that's there?
But in the traumatic experience, there's also a threat. Like if you're in a bad situation, you don't realize. You don't see it.
It depends, right? Because when we can understand a verse that says, that Allah does not place upon an individual burden greater than their capacity to bear. Sharia doesn't create problems for you, but things that exist outside of Sharia can create problems for you. Humanity, systems, structures, they can become very oppressive, right? Dr. Shadi Al-Masri, people know him from the New Brunswick Islamic Center. He has like a really great kind of soundbite on this, where he says, God won't place a burden upon you greater than your ability to bear, but humans will place burdens upon you greater than your ability to bear. People will place burdens upon you. And it's important. You want to understand it. Some people go through real hell. They go through real, real difficulty. Theological questions cannot be answered with platitudes. How can you make sense to someone who struggles with the idea of why is there a God that would create a pandemic? Black people who try to understand the existence of slavery, the existence of a stratified society, of anti-blackness, from slavery to Jim Crow to mass incarceration. Theological responses are incumbent upon those in our community that have the skill to not just parrot, but to really think with an air of compassion and mercy, what is it that we're really saying to the person, you know, and where their struggles are. And so there's categorical difference between individuals who are in certain spaces, and we have to be comfortable with that. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? I want to go through some of the rest of this because I think it's important. Spend some time with yourself, just thinking about your relationship to your faith, of what comes next. It feels like instant gratification. In the longer sense of existence, this world is going to feel like a drop in the bucket in terms of what comes after this, because it's temporary in relation to what's forever. You don't want to lose sight of it. You want to think about how do you create reminders, right? I had a student who was once in a leadership position here. In his like notebook that he put for his own leadership, right at the front, there was a sticker that he wrote in Arabic, "Fi sabilillah." Every time he opened it, it was the first thing he saw. When I used to play sports, I'm sure you can tell I was an athlete given how large and huge I am, right? Before I got injured in high school, I used to play sports. Everything was about mental strength. Everything was about phrases that were constantly everywhere that told you to play with your heart, to lead with your heart, to be mentally strong, to play like a champion. It was all about creating a mindset that had deliberate reminders again and again and again. If you walk on streets that are purposely built with a secular framework that deny the gift that's a spiritual gift of reflecting on death, and have no semblance whatsoever of any indication of accountability, right? Look at the people around you. A lot of the people who make these decisions, they do not care about anything other than self-gain. Why would you want to be a person like this? Honestly, why? How much money is worth it to make you validate and justify somebody else's mistreatment? Doesn't mean you walk into your office place tomorrow and like start a revolution. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying as an individual, you look within yourself. You take the examples of those that you deem to be who you want to be like. You have a good envy. You take a reflection to really be able to say, how do my decisions and choices demonstrate something that is eternal in its existence, is coming? It doesn't need for me to believe in it for it to be true. This is what they're coming to remind people of. That, hey, there is a next world. Hey, there's something else. It's an empowering theology. This is why all of the prophets of God had poor people, people of different cultures, people who were ostracized and alienated by societies. They were the first followers of prophets because it speaks differently to them. That, you know what? This world does not make sense without another world coming after it. Doesn't make sense without a day of judgment. Do you know what I mean? Don't get diluted, right? Al-Hakum Utagathur, the verse says. Don't get distracted by the acquisition and the piling up of just materialistic things. Don't get distracted. Wake up. And then it starts to give us different descriptions of the one who yukadhibu bid-deen. فَذَلِكَ الَّذِي يَدُعُ الْيَتِيمِ. Right? So that is very like that person, then that one, right? الَّذِي is the one who يَدْعُ الْيَتِيمِ. They push out the orphan. This word that says to push out, it has a different recitation also that is about calling, right? Like the way we say dua. And so in that recitation, what it's saying is that the person calls the orphan, but just uses them for what they need, and then just pushes them away still, sends them away. It's a very self-serving relationship. The specificity of the yatim should not be lost upon us. In our Sharia, a yatim is somebody who loses their parent at a young age, not as an old age, right? So we have individuals whose mothers and fathers pass away and they're much older. I'm turning 40 this year, right? My parents are still alive, alhamdulillah, may Allah grant them good health and ease in their old age. They pass away one day, and if they pass away before I pass away, it's a reality. I might die tomorrow. But if my parents pass away before me, I'm not going to be able to say I'm an orphan, right? Because I'm a whole man at this point. We're kind of semi, not young enough to be. Here, the idea is like a literal pushing out. That they're in a space and you are literally pushing them out of the space. The yatim is very important to understand, both literally and figuratively, because the yatim is one who they can't give you anything in return for treating them right. They don't have anything. I've been in refugee camps in the world where there are orphans. Some days, thousands of children walk in unaccompanied. As orphans of genocide, there's not a single soul in the world that knows they exist. Their entire villages have been annihilated. May Allah grant them ease. It's a very different type of loneliness. What's that kid going to be able to give to you for you sponsoring them? Nothing. What are they going to do for you? Nothing. It's not that they're helpless. You don't help someone just to assume they're helpless, but they don't have anything. They can't pay you back. It's a relationship of benefits to soften the heart, because it's one of the few relationships where you can only give and not get something back, right? If one of you comes and asks me for help for something and I help you, I'm going to help you because I love you. You don't have to give me anything back, but you have the capacity to give me something back. This is a class of individual that does not have the ability to give you back. There's no reciprocity in the benefit in that sense, tangibly. It's an intangible benefit. This is why these people don't want to do for them, because I don't see a gain back to me for doing for you. I can usurp your wealth. I can take control of you as a child and then reap your materialistic gain. But I'm not doing it because it's the right thing. You want to take care of orphans in specific. If you are blessed to be married, you are blessed to have children or not, whether you are married or not as well, but it's an individual decision. If you have the capacity to specifically provide care for an orphan, you want to. And if God has given you the wealth and the heart to be able to bring an orphan into your home, you want to. Foster care systems filled with children who are just neglected. I have been called in the middle of the night to people's homes where child services have had children who live in houses that are filled with hell, that they're trying to now get the child out of the house because the family is not treating them well. They get stuck in systems where they are potentially nice people who will look after them, but also the potential of people who look to scam systems, take governmental stipends. Those are there. You are good people. Good people should be taking care of orphans. Does that make sense? There's no shortage of recommendation in our hadith that talks about this. Now you want to think about this as a first indicator of how you juxtapose one who is within this religion. You cannot rely purely on ritualistic practice. I pray amazingly. That's my ticket to Jannah. If you really have faith in this thing, then you are going to never push away someone who's in need. Mistreat them, abuse them, mock them. It's not qualified. It's not saying just the yatim who is in a place where they share race with you, culture with you, religion with you, whatever. And the specificity of it is also meant to sting the heart. Do you remember that guy? Do you reflect on that person who didn't do right by that one orphan specifically? People who are reading this, they're listening to it. The way people come up to me after Jummah sometimes, and they say, I felt like you were just staring at me the whole time, Jummah. I'm not staring at you. I felt like everything you said, you were just saying it to me directly. I'm like, no, it wasn't. But the Quran stylistically is written grammatically in ways too, where the utilization of singular versus plural, the utilization of the past versus present versus future, an active voice and passive voice, it's purposeful. Right? This is written by the most wise of those who have wisdom. And so it's getting those people also with a sense of care. Wake up. Stop abusing those who have nothing. And it's starting to give a shape of what does it mean to be a good Muslim? You don't want to be the person who thinks that my afterlife is secure based simply on ritualistic practice. to how you treat others, how you are aware of others' realities. Those are things that are important. The one who pushes the orphan away, you read this verse, you want to embrace the orphan, bring them close. You can literally go online right now. And for just dollars a month, you can support an orphan. Just like that, mindlessly. You don't even have to pay attention to it. The ideal, which does not mean that there's not blessing in doing that, going online and encouraging your friends, but the ideal is that it's a one-to-one interaction. There's not a lot of Muslims who are foster parents in the country, let alone in New York City. I love every time I get an email, which is a lot more frequently than it was before, from individuals and couples in our community that say, how do I adopt somebody? That there must be so many children right now in the world who don't have people looking at them. And that's because of war and conflict and everything else. It's also because parents don't honor the rights of their kids. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? وَلَا يَحُدُّ عَلَىٰ طَعَامِ الْمِسْكِينَ. And they don't encourage others to feed the poor, right? This is talking about those who are in leadership positions. Look at like the people, like just look, reflective. Not criticism, you can criticize one. Just look, there are not politicians who launch campaigns saying that we need to feed the masses. There are not people who stand up and say, let's go and take care of the poor and combat homelessness and all this kind of stuff. There's some, right? You had Rana, who is in our community, running for Congress. They literally changed the district lines so she couldn't run. That's crazy. The woman she was running against hates Islam. She literally stood in Congress wearing a burqa to demonize in a very Islamophobic stance. Rana, who I know, some of you know her, she's got an Umrah with us from here. She came and spoke in Ramadan. She prayed here in our community for a while. She's from Queens. She has a love for New York. She sees the challenge that rent prices are going up. She sees the challenge that there's gentrification that's taking place constantly. There are people that run like that, and they're not seen through the establishment as those that want to be promoted or pushed forward, right? It's a problem. So here you have embedded in this. They're not telling people, they're not encouraging people, urging them towards what's right. And it goes back to what you're saying before, the environment that you're situated in is going to then impact who you are as a product of a person. If you're not hearing voices of encouragement towards what's good, it's going to have this impact on you. It doesn't say ida'am, the feeding of. Da'am is different from ida'am. This is telling us that they're not even giving them the food that's meant to be theirs. It's not saying, I'm not encouraging you to take from your food and take from your food and feed somebody, but it's saying that those who are in authority, they're not even telling these people to give the people the food that was theirs to begin with. You can go to different parts of New York City, and this community, which I'm every day more proud of, has fed entire neighborhoods, 500, 600 families in Ramadan who have no food, nothing to eat. They just don't have anything, nothing. Systemically, structurally, things are purposely built to benefit the privileged and to continue to underserve those who are underserved and underprivileged. Our religion is teaching us that this is a sign of an absence of faith. This is a sign that you don't believe that there is a day of judgment. So the opposite again. You want to be in a place where you can recognize your degrees are great, your credentials are great, We also want to aspire to have the station that you are the means through which Allah feeds his creation. You are the means through which Allah clothes his creation, gives shelter to his creation. And don't get lost in a scale of grandeur, even if it's one person that you're providing this for. You start to see where there is indication of how it's not just simply you stand and bow and prostrate, you read the words of the Quran, you got to live them. And you can't justify and validate. There's literal hadith where the companions come and they ask the Prophet, what do you say of a woman who she prays in the night, she gives a lot in charity, she fasts regularly, giving indication of beyond the minimum, but she harms her neighbors. Her neighbors are not protected from her. The Prophet says unequivocally, La khayra fiha, hiya min ahlin nar. There's no good in her. She is from the people of Jahannam. Allah protect us from becoming believers. Then he talks about a woman who does the bare minimum. Doesn't give extra, doesn't do so much, but people are protected from her talk. He says, hiya min ahlin jannah. She's from the people of paradise. That etiquette, that social responsibility is very critical. These are giving indications now. And the people in Mecca in real time, they don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear that I'm going to be accountable. I don't want to hear that I'm supposed to somehow be comfortable now sitting next to a poor person. Or that there's something that's wrong with me. God's going to be upset with me because I decided to just take something that belonged to somebody else. It makes a very distinct shift now from the rights of people to the rights of Allah, which is what we talked about last week. How you honor the rights of people will indicate an impact on your relationship with Allah. فَوَيْلٌ لِلْمُصَلِينَ, the verse stops. We're taught that if you read this in Salah, you can't stop your recitation at this. The other verses have to come. But there's a pause here, and it's purposeful because this is talking to everybody that makes salah. If you make salah and you're sitting in this room, you are now woken up to the reality of what this verse is telling you. It's telling you, hey, performer of your salah, what's coming next, it might be applicable to you. That could be any one of us. The whale is a very particular part of Jahannam. May Allah protect us from it. In other chapters of the Quran, وَيْلٌ لِكُلِّ هُمَزَةٍ لُمَزَةٍ, that the whale is for the slanderer, the gossiper, the backbiter. وَيْلٌ لِلْمُطَفِّفِينَ, right? You're not doing right in your business transactions. The whale is for you. It talks about real serious things. And now it's applying this into that list of individuals. The whale is defined in some hadith as the part of Jahannam that's so cold, it can burn you. It's a part of Jahannam, may Allah protect us from it, that all you do is fall in it. You just fall in it. There's no stoppage to it. So the one that makes salah in reconciling, is this a Medinese or a Meccan chapter? Some would say it's Medinese because it's talking about the injunction of salah. Some would say that no, the salah is in reference to people were praying even before the command of the daily prayers. Allah knows best, right? Just think about its application back to you. الَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنْ صَلَاتِهِمْ سَاهُونَ. The two words here that are really important, we're going to stop in like 4 minutes, just go through it really quick. The an is important because it doesn't say fi, it says an. So it's about the concept of their prayer, the relationship to their prayer. It's not within your prayer that you are sahun. It is about your prayer, around the idea of the prayer. Because all of us have negligence in our prayer. We all make mistakes, right? Alhamdulillah that we have a merciful God that understands that our mind is going to be distracted. We're going to be thinking about different things. It'll be easy for us to be swayed in different ways. But this is about how you relate to the prayer. Sahun is a negligence of forgetfulness that if you have traits and characteristics of it, it's like, I'm going to pray, but just towards the end of it. It's not that really big a deal. It's not the priority. This religion centers itself around self-management, and time management is essentially self-management. And our routine is rooted around the performance of 5 daily prayers. There's different opinions on the start time and end times of prayers, but nobody argues that there are less than 5 in a day. You don't want to be one who makes reasons as to why you have negligence in relation to your salah. This is a right of Allah. And when something is a fard, it's owed. And so on that Yom al-Din, right? الَّذِي يُكَذِّبُ بِالدِّينِ, the idea is that there's hisab done. Did you do and fulfill what was expected of you? So sahun is the person who says, you know, I know there was other kind of classes available at NYU. There were different sections I could go to, but I decided to pick the one that was in the middle of Jumu'ah prayer. Because it's hard for me to wake up earlier than 1 o'clock in the afternoon, right? You don't want to do that. That's what this verse is saying. You don't want to be the person who sees it as a secondary. It's got to be a priority. It's not negligence in the prayer. It's negligence in relation to the concept of the salah. It's an important thing. It's a priority. And the person who doesn't prioritize it, they're being made parallel to the one who pushes away the orphan, the one who keeps food away from the miskin. You know what the word miskin means, right? Like if I say I live somewhere, right? I say, you know, Eskun fi Medina, New York. I live in New York. This is where I reside. The miskin has the same root. Because they essentially just, they live in their poverty. They're stuck in their poverty. There's no way out of their poverty. They're just in their need. That's their default setting. And Allah is saying that if you don't take your prayer seriously, you're willing to say it's not a big deal. You're going to then be in a place where that first verse comes back to you. It's not easy living in this society. Struggling to wake up for Fajr is different than saying, I planned my meeting in the middle of the time for Maghrib. Struggling to wake up for Fajr is not the same as saying, I'm going to stay awake till 1-2 o'clock in the morning and then wonder why I didn't wake up to pray. I'm going to go home. I'm so happy Isha's as early as it is. I love sleeping. I cannot function off of 5-6 hours a day, especially day after day after day. I'm going to get in my bed at 9:30. I'm going to wake up early enough to be present in my prayer. And then I'm going to start the rest of my day because I don't wake up to go back to sleep. I wake up to be awake. And anything that I'm going to do for fleeting moments, tell me honestly, can you remember when you have cried in your prayer? A moment where your heart trembled? You made dua and you just didn't want to stop making dua? Can you tell me what you did on Saturday night 3 years ago? Can you tell me what you did on Friday night 6 months ago? Most of those things that are keeping us awake and negligent are not even things that we retain for the most part. If you do not prioritize it, it's your decision. So here it's saying that is a part of what goes into this. الَّذِينَ هُمْ يُرَاعُونَ وَيَمْنَعُونَ الْمَاعُونَ. The word يُرَاعُونَ is about making a show of something, right? They associate it with prayer also. This is one of the recommendations that you pray your sunnah and your nawafil in your house so that you're praying in privacy. Because you could come and pray here and it's just for show. That people could say, oh, look at how great that recitation is. Mashallah, that guy prays so much. They just keep praying all the time, right? The definition of this word, yura'un, is that somebody is essentially performing an act, a deed, to be able to solicit praise that they're not actually deserving of. It's all just for a show. You don't want to do that. We have na'un al-ma'un, and they don't even do like the little things. They deny like the small acts, the expressions of gratitude, holding the door open, helping to clean up. You know, we had, and I'll say this as the last thing, because the two points that I want you to take from this the most, go home and reflect on your relationship to the afterlife. What does a day of judgment mean to you? What does eternal existence mean to you? And think about that for yourself, conviction-wise. How are my decisions, my actions informed by it? The reality that is a day of judgment. What's getting in the way? And then these signs, take them as specifics, but also as generics. And why certain things can cloud us. We had iftar the other day. I don't know if it was for the day of Arafah or the day of Ashura. And there were still people in the room at the night while we were cleaning. And two of our community members, their mother was here, older than a good number of the people in the room. I got on the mic. There's probably like 50 people still in the room. I think we had 400 or 500 for iftar. And I got and I said, who can help to just wash like the serving spoons and dishes? And the only person that came up was the mother of these two people. And she came and she was like, I'll do it. And she was excited to do it. And I got on the mic and I said, hold on. What are you all doing? How is it acceptable that the eldest person in the room is the only person that's getting up to do something? Those people that you're talking to right now, the laughter, like the jokes, whatever it is, like, what are you doing? Don't pass up on small acts. They make all the difference. When you're done here, give salams. It's a small act. You don't have to be a hafiz to do that. You don't have to be giving the khutbah. You literally just have to overcome inside of yourself and shake somebody's hand. Ask them, hey, next week, you want to come and have dinner with me afterwards? Maybe we can get to know one another, right? The Prophet alayhi salam says, the best amongst you is the one who greets whom they know and greets whom they don't know. Why is that not you? You get what I mean? You do the little things, the bigger things are not going to be as hard to do. And you start to pay attention to them. From your heart, you see what's there. You don't need someone's permission to do it.
We hope you enjoyed our podcast. If you're inspired by the work that we're doing at the IC and want to help keep it going, subscribe to our podcasts, follow us on social media, donate to help support us at icnyu.org, and most importantly, keep us in your continued du'as. Until next time, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum.